All right, let's get started. Good morning.
Good morning.
That was acceptable, I guess. All right. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Scott Schnall. I'm a senior program manager on the Office 365 customer experience team. Among other things, I'm responsible for areas such as risk assurance, compliance, auditing, standards, et cetera, et cetera. Very different from a lot of the Exchange work to do. So needless to say, I'm extremely excited to be back here presenting another Exchange tips and tricks session. This one, though, I want you to know I did not have anything to do with the title of the session, so I don't want you to think that I intentionally put my name in it or said that you should experience it live. In fact, probably most of you know I've always delivered this live. It's never been a recording, so the fact that you're experiencing it live is great. Now, a couple housekeeping matters. I notice some of you taking pictures in other sessions. That is totally okay if you want to do that. Feel free to take as many of me or the content as you want. Just try not to disturb others. But I will tell you that every session is being recorded and every deck will be available for download, so you don't have to copy necessarily everything that's on the screen. But if you want to, it's totally cool. Now, for those of you with devices that make noise, please silence them. Again, we are recording this, and it's just out of courtesy to your neighbors as well. The other thing I want to mention is this deck in particular you'll want to download, because those of you who have seen me deliver these sessions before know I like to stick a lot of additional content in the notes. And in fact, I've done that again, and I've got assurances from our slide deck people that it will not be scrubbed out, so they should be available when you download this deck. If they're not, let me know. You can see my email address up there. I will go ahead and take care of it or just send you the annotated version. Also, if you have any questions that we don't get a chance to get to, or if you think of questions after the session, please do feel free to take down my email address and email me with any of your questions. I might not know the right answer, but there's a pretty good chance I know who does. So again, feel free to send me any questions that you have. All right, how many of you have attended a tips and tricks session before for Exchange? All right, wow, that's a lot of you. How many of you are running Exchange 2007? Is anybody still on 2007? Okay, couple hands. 2010. Wow, the majority so far. 2013. Wow, almost the same people. 2016. Wow. Is anybody completely in the cloud? Few hands. Anybody hybrid? All right. So I think we have something for everyone in here. Maybe not so much for the 2007 or 2010 folks, but there should be something in here for everyone, regardless of what you're running. And of course, my clicker's broken, so I'll be standing here now. All right, so typically the way I like to do these sessions is I like to start out and kind of level set with the basics and where we are right now. Often I find this is stuff that a lot of the audience does know, but if you are on an earlier release of Exchange and you're not quite keeping up with our release cadence, then this is going to be pretty important information for you to have as we move along. So let's start how we're developing Exchange now. So we've been doing this for a few years. We've started out way back in 2009 when we were working on Exchange 2010. When we started looking at different ways that we could merge the code base and at the same time do innovation into the cloud offering, which was called BPOS back then, and make it greater than what we were doing on premises. We were still largely focused on premises at the time, but that was really when we started to split off into groups that were working on cloud work. The way it works now, and the way it's worked for the past couple versions of Exchange, is we are doing the majority of innovation in the cloud. So we spec a new feature, we develop that feature, we release it in pre-release, typically to Microsoft folks first, then to the general world in the cloud. We get a few iterations of feedback on those features, and then if appropriate, they will make their way into on-premises and get shipped as part of either a major release or one of our cumulative updates. And in fact, with CU3 for Exchange 2016, which was just released a week ago, we in fact shipped a new contact and people experience that now mirrors what we're doing in the cloud. So those of you running 2016 on-premises, if you installed CU3, then you'll get a lot of the same experience that we have in the cloud. Not every single thing that we develop, obviously, is going to work well in the cloud. There are some features that we have that require massive computing resources that on-premises customers simply aren't going to have access to. Things like Delve and the Office Graph, where we're not just using Office 365 computers for that. We also leverage, for example, some of the Bing servers when they're idle, because we want to keep all our servers running hot, and we want to leverage all that compute power. So that's how we do innovation. In terms of our life cycle, where we are, just again to set the level, we did just release our third cumulative update for Exchange 2016. Exchange 2016 RTM'd a year ago. In fact, it's almost a year to the day. It became generally available a couple days later. Usually takes us a couple days to sign the bits and get them distributed to the servers. And then since GA, we've had three updates, CU1, 2, and 3, the cumulative updates. If you are on an older version of Exchange, 2010, 2007, you're more used to update rollups. I'll talk about some of the changes that we made between CUs and update rollups in a bit. Now, for those of you keeping current on 2016, if you are running CU3, you may notice right away, particularly those of you who use monitoring solutions that plug into managed availability, that we introduced a behavior change with CU3. Prior to CU3, when the system would go into the prerequisite analysis phase, which is basically looking at the box and making sure that all the prereqs are on there, before it would do that analysis, it would turn off the managed availability monitoring, or basically the responders. We call that server-wide offlining. Okay, so that means managed availability is still there, but it's basically instructed by setup at this time not to respond to anything, not to do anything. So prior to CU3, we would start the server-wide offline at this point. With CU3, we're actually doing it later, after we've done the prereq analysis. So that's a big change. But the change really is so that we can make sure that the server doesn't go into the setup maintenance mode unless and until we verify that all the prereqs are on the box and the server is in fact ready for Exchange to come out and new bits to come on in. So that is another change. This change actually really largely affects the GUI users mostly. I mean, command line setup has the same behavior, but when you come to prereq analysis in command line, if you don't meet all the prereqs, it exits out and you have to restart it. With the GUI, if you don't meet all the prereqs, we've got a new behavior in there that we can work around that I'll talk about in a bit. But one of the other major things that we did, you may have noticed, if particularly those of you running a mix of 2013 and 2016, you might notice quite a difference between the two packages that we're delivering. You know, why, for instance, is Exchange 2013 1.6 gigs, and Exchange 2016 could be anywhere from 5.7, which is what CU3 was, to actually 6.4, which was what CU2 was before CU3. So we did a few things. When we build Exchange in our production environment, the source tree is different from the repository where the final build gets. So as the source tree is running and compiling and creating all the exes, DLLs, and everything else that we use, that stuff then gets transported over the network and over to the release staging site where we then can take the ISO and do whatever we want with it, such as putting it on the download center. So we expanded the release. We actually refactored our development process so that everything is expanded and broken out now. We also added a ton of new languages in Exchange 2016 that weren't in previous versions. So between breaking things out, factoring things out, and adding all these new languages, the actual size of the download is now several more gigabytes than what it used to be. So it could be anywhere from 5.7 to, like I said, 6.4 with CU2. And that's without the UM language packs. The UM language packs you still have to download separately. So Exchange got a lot bigger, but for us, we had to do this. This was a huge advantage for us. Those of you who have looked at some of the bits that we drop on the server know that, particularly with things like Outlook on the web, there are a lot of teeny tiny little files in it. And with the CRC checking that we had on the network, all those tiny files were just killing us. It would take anywhere from 15 to 20 minutes to copy from the production system over to the release system. Now we've actually got it down to about 54 seconds by refactoring things, by breaking things out, and by converting into an ISO versus a self-extracting ESC. So if you're wondering where that change came from, that was really something to help our production environment be much quicker and more agile. It's not really affecting you, except that now you have a little bit larger download to deal with. Now, for those of you who are running Exchange, we have a one-stop shop where you can get all of the supportability requirements in one page. It's actually called the Exchange Server Supportability Matrix. You can use that shortcut URL to get to it, and it will talk about everything related to Exchange. Now, those of you paying attention to Exchange documentation, you've probably seen a lot of changes going on. So let me fill you in on some of those changes, because they do affect the supportability matrix and some of the other things that we published. So you may know that Exchange product documentation is published to TechNet. What you might not know is that TechNet is really nothing more than a publishing platform for us. So they provide the platform, we provide the content, and the two come together to create a site for you. TechNet as a platform, as a publishing platform, is being phased out at Microsoft. So you may have noticed documentation teams now have their content all over the place. Some have it on TechNet still while they're waiting to see where they're going to go. Some, like the Exchange content, is being moved over to support.office.com. Some from like the EMS team is going to docs.microsoft.com. And other teams that produce content within Microsoft are also kind of experimenting with what platform they're going to use. So no single team has decided that the platform they're using is like the best place to be. So you may see stuff moving around in the future as well, including the server supportability matrix. However, we are using forwarding and redirecting so that if this, for instance, gets moved to support.office.com or docs.microsoft.com or wherever it goes, that same shortcut link will still take you to wherever it lands. So if you're seeing a lot of stuff happening with content, it's because there is a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes right now. Now, in the supportability matrix, a couple of the things that we talk about are how we deliver updates for Exchange. And again, in the past, prior to Exchange 2013, we were delivering what we would call update rollups. So we would take a bunch of code, package it up in an update package, and give you that to deploy on your servers. We don't do that anymore. With 2013 and 2016, we now use cumulative updates, which is basically the entire product itself. And that's one of the reasons why a cumulative update is the same thing as a service pack, just with a different name. And it's also why, because it's the full package of Exchange, whenever you install a cumulative update or a service pack, we're actually going to uninstall the existing bits and then do a new install on top of it. Okay, and that's important to note, because those of you who are doing customizations in the file system, for instance, a lot of customers will modify some of the web.config files, that stuff is going to get overwritten by a CU or by a service pack being introduced. So you'll want to have a change management process that can put that stuff back into place when you're done with it. So you can see, for instance, update rollups only apply to 2007 and 2010. Security updates are being delivered separately now with cumulative updates in 2013 and 2016. And then, of course, the operating system support. So as you can see, the matrix is very large. Now that we have multiple versions of Exchange that we need to cover and multiple versions of Windows that we need to cover, now including Windows Server 2016, now we have a much larger matrix of combinations of supported servers and operating systems. The X with the one there means it's a management tools only deployment. So not everywhere you see an X means you can plop an Exchange server there. Some of those are only supported just for the management tools. I find a lot of customers aren't even bothering with the management tool deployment anymore, since EAC is a web page and PowerShell is all remote anyway. So you don't get a lot of benefits, but you will get some shortcuts if you do install the management tools. One thing that you will no longer get, though, is the compiled HTML help file that we used to ship with Exchange, or what we used to call the CHUM file for short, which is basically all the product documentation that you'd find on TechNet, but in an offline CHM file. We are not shipping that anymore, and as with TechNet going away, they're taking their print-a-book platform with them, too. So we're trying to figure out a solution long-term for offline content, but right now we don't have one. All right, let's talk a little bit more about Windows 2016, because it did just come out, and about a week ago when we released CU3, we did also announce our support for Windows 2016. So in fact, the way that we announced it may not have been entirely clear to everyone. I think a lot of customers read that, okay, I can just grab Windows 2016 and start deploying Exchange on it. That's actually not the case. What we're really saying is, if you do decide to roll out Windows 2016 in your organization and you want to run Exchange on premises, then Exchange has to be 2016 CU3 or later in order to do that. No earlier versions, including earlier versions of Exchange, are supported on Windows 2016. It's CU3, which again got released a week ago, and later, so any future ones that we released. Not too much changes in terms of how we're leveraging the operating system or how we're leveraging the AD functionality. So for instance, you probably won't have to raise your force functional level. We can still keep it at 2008 R2. If you're much higher, we support that as well, but the minimum you have to be at is 2008 R2. Now, there's a lot of new features in Windows 2016, high availability features, networking features, all sorts of cool things. Exchange 2016 is not taking advantage of any of them. However, there is a change to Windows Installer in Windows 2016 that does give you an improvement to the Exchange setup experience. And what that is Windows Installer now, when you're installing the operating system prerequisites, no longer needs a reboot before you do that. So what that means, particularly if you're using the GUI version of setup, that means that you can actually start with a domain join machine, run Exchange setup. If any prereqs are missing, typically we're looking at UCMA, which would be the only prereq you have to put on 2016. But if that is missing, you could leave the GUI system running, install UCMA in the background, and then in the GUI setup, there's a retry button. You just hit that button, and it will do a reanalysis, figure out that the prereq is there now, and keep going. So I know it doesn't sound like a big deal, but if you've ever run setup and had it tell you there were prereqs missing and you've had to exit out and restart from the beginning, now you no longer have to do that on Exchange 2016 with Windows 2016. Simply leave the GUI open, do whatever prereq work you need to do, hit retry, and it will just continue where it left off. So there is an improved setup experience, but right now, that's all we're leveraging in Windows. The other thing to keep in mind is, just like the other versions of Windows, you can't upgrade the operating system with Exchange on the box. But of course, right out of the gate, we've solved that since we require Exchange CU3 to go to Windows anyway. And of course, you can't use Recover Server to change the OS. You're always going to have to recover back to the operating system on which it was already running. So if you want to take advantage of Windows 2016 for Exchange, the only way to do that is still new installs. And like I said, it's got to be new installs of 2016 CU3 or later. And then the other thing we want you to be aware of is Windows Defender is now on by default in Windows 2016. And it's particularly important that the Exchange installation path and the setup logs, and then later on the Node Runner processes once Exchange is installed, that all of that get excluded from Windows Defender doing its scanning. If Windows Defender starts scanning or doing things in the setup logs folder, it could substantially slow down setup or even cause setup to break if it's locking a file that setup needs to write to. So keep that in mind. All right. Now the other tricky thing is with .NET Framework support. So if you are going to do Exchange 2016 on Windows Server 2016, you have to run .NET 4.6.2. If you're not running on Windows 2016 and you're taking Exchange 2016 on any other operating system or CU2 or any earlier version, then 4.6.1 is the latest. And there are also some post 4.6.1 updates that you need to install as well. So basically the prereqs right now are the .NET platform, the updates for the .NET platform, and then UCMA. And then that's it. WMF, which is Windows Management Framework and PowerShell, we'll talk about in a second, still a prereq, but built into the OS. But for .NET, 4.62 is required on Windows 2016, 4.61 is required everywhere else. Now, if you have to uninstall .NET and the system is already running Exchange, before you reinstall .NET, you have to run an optimization script so that .NET can basically recompile all of the .NET assemblies that are on the box. When you uninstall .NET, all of those compiled assemblies, which .NET is doing during setup, those all go away with it. So you have to run the script, and there's a command line or a PowerShell version that you can run. Running either of these scripts will solve the problem for you, but they must be done if you're removing .NET from an existing Exchange server before you reinstall .NET on that same server. And then I mentioned the Windows Management Framework support. So we are making a support statement starting with Exchange 2016, but we haven't really made a big deal about it and announced it. But the support statement with respect to Windows Management Framework and therefore PowerShell is we're only going to be supporting now the versions of WMF and PowerShell that come with the operating system or an update to a supported operating system. Okay, and that's a big change. I know some of you have experiences installing down-level versions of WMF or the standalone versions that we had out. That is not going to be, and it's not a supported activity anymore. So no more down-level standalone implementations of WMF and PowerShell. We're only supporting what's coming with the operating system. So that could be RTM of the operating system, or if there's an update later on, whatever update that is, that version. All right, how many of you have heard of the Exchange Deployment Assistant? Okay, I'd say probably a quarter of the room. This is a wonderful site and a wonderful tool for you to use. And I would recommend that anybody deploying Exchange on premises today use this assistant, because it's not just the website that you see here, it's an actual tool that you just answer a few questions, and based on the answers that you give, it will give you step-by-step instructions for doing your actual deployment. How to install the prereqs, how to make sure AD is ready, how to actually run Exchange setup, what to do when you're done with Exchange setup, how to configure things after the servers have been installed, how to get mail flow going, how to get public folders going, how to set up an edge transport server if you're using one of those in your perimeter network. It'll walk you through everything. A couple things I want to point out, though. If you go to the website today, which you can get there with that short URL, you'll see under the Exchange 2016 scenarios, it says coming soon for a couple of them. The coming soon, removing that, is actually just an oversight on our part. Those scenarios are there and in the tool and available for you to use today. We just forgot to take the coming soon off the web page. So we've got a bug and an action item to do that, so the coming soon is going to disappear. But all the scenarios that are listed on the page, including not just these, but all of these as well, all of those are there and ready to go. So are you coming from 2010? Are you coming from 2013? Are you coming from a mixed environment of both? Do you have public folders? Do you want a hybrid deployment? Do you want an on-premises deployment? Any scenario that involves an admin deploying Exchange is covered by the Deployment Assistant. And we are constantly working on improvements to it as well. If you haven't seen it, again, I strongly recommend having a look at it, even if you have experience deploying Exchange, just to make sure that you haven't forgotten anything, because we cover everything that you absolutely have to do to get a running Exchange organization. Now, let's also talk about the preferred architecture. So this is something that we introduced a couple years ago for Exchange, and this is basically the Exchange engineering team telling everybody exactly how we would like you to deploy things. Now, there's nothing in Exchange that's enforcing this. There's nothing in our tools that's saying, oh, you're violating this or anything. But this is the architecture that we want everybody to deploy. One, because we know it's the optimum architecture for on-premises deployments. And two, because it is actually very similar to how we deploy Exchange Online. Now, you won't be able to do everything that we do in Exchange Online, but you will be able to match our architecture in terms of using a DAG with the right number of copies and having the proper number of servers and the right amount of memory and everything else that you can think of in terms of architecting an on-premises design. I'm not going to talk too much about it because we do have a whole session on it, and I hope everybody goes to that on Wednesday. But it is specifically designed to give you the highest levels of availability that you can, while at the same time not only decreasing complexity, but really substantially reducing your messaging costs. And when I say substantially, we have very good evidence from customer deployments that messaging costs, depending on your environment, could go down anywhere from 50 to 80% based on this architecture. So it really is something that we want you to deploy if you're going to deploy on premises. And of course, once you have the architecture down, we have the server role requirements calculator for you to use. And the requirements calculator will not only tell you exactly how to build your servers, but there are buttons that you can push and it will create scripts for you, PowerShell scripts that will do things like create a DAG for you, create databases in the DAG, and lay out those databases exactly the way the calculator and the preferred architecture want you to. So if you haven't seen the calculator, then you are seriously missing out on a necessary tool that every Exchange administrator should have. So you definitely want to download it. Now, a couple things I'll tell you. So we have one calculator for Exchange 2013 and 2016. When you're on the blog or where you're reading things, sometimes, as you can see, for instance, from the short URL, we're referencing Exchange 2013. But it's the same one calendar that you'll use for 2016 as well. We just didn't change all the URLs because we didn't want to break anybody else's experience. So when you go to that URL, it'll take you to this page on the gallery where you can download the requirements calculator. It's an Excel spreadsheet, so you'll need Excel to use it. Then you just plug in your numbers, and it will tell you exactly how you need to design your Exchange system. The other thing that I like about this page is I know it's difficult for some of you to read, but there's a very lovely description down there. So visit the page and read that, and it's pretty good for a laugh there. All right, that's the basics. So now let's get into some categories of areas that I think it's important to talk about with customers. So let's start by talking about some HA stuff, some high availability stuff. How many of you are doing high availability on premises? All right, that's awesome. How many of you are not? Two people, okay, get out. No, I'm serious, I'll wait. All right. Again, I don't want to steal anyone's thunder. I know Andrew's giving the HA deep dive on Friday. It's going to be an awesome session, so you definitely want to go and check out all that stuff. But I thought rather than tell you what he's going to tell you, I'm going to tell you all the stuff he's not going to tell you. So, he's going to talk about auto reseed. How many of you have not heard of auto reseed? Oh, awesome, just a couple of you. So, auto reseed is code inside of Exchange, server and online, that when it detects a failed disk that would normally contain an Exchange database or its log files, if the disk fails, auto reseed will automatically grab a spare disk that's been provisioned by the administrator, format that disk, and then automatically reseed the copies of the databases that were destroyed from the dead disk. So auto reseed was actually something that was born in Exchange Online. You saw from the video that we have more than 1 million servers in our data centers worldwide. So knowing that we have more than 1 million servers, you can imagine how many hard drives we have. And how often they fail, not because we buy bad ones, but simply because of the sheer number of them, we're going to see a general statistical failure of them. So in the service, in Exchange Online, and really in all of Office 365, we call our administrators operators. Before auto reseed, when a disk died in the service, we had to send an operator out there to pull out the disk, put in a new one, manually format it, and then manually reseed while doing a babysitting job of the reseed to make sure it finished. Now, as you might imagine, if we're trying to run a service with low costs, sending humans out to do manual tasks is not going to save us money. In fact, it's very, very expensive to have to do that. So that's where auto reseed came from. We obviated the need to have humans go do it because we taught the system to do it itself. The administrator simply pre-provisions one or two disks, and the system will take it from there. And in fact, using auto reseed is part of the preferred architecture. Using BitLocker is also part of the preferred architecture. How many of you are using BitLocker on your Exchange servers? All right, that's not as many hands as I was hoping to see. BitLocker, but I may have an answer for why that is in a minute. BitLocker is also Strongly recommended because it does give you encryption at rest of the volumes. How you implement that will be up to you. Typically, most customers won't go and do things like use a PIN unlock. They'll just have BitLocker integrated with the trusted platform module in the hardware and let the system automatically reboot but keep the volume encrypted. So the process for deploying BitLocker on an Exchange volume actually changed in CU2, not the one we released last week, but the one before that about 3 months ago. We made a modification to the disk reclaimer, and we introduced a new parameter. It's the auto DAG BitLocker enabled property, and that basically is how you're telling the DAG that this is a BitLocker protected DAG, and therefore you need to be aware of that and do things a little differently with respect to auto reseed, because there's some encryption that needs to take place as well. So we have this wonderful blog article that Ross wrote that takes you through all the steps of implementing BitLocker on your Exchange server, gives you all the requirements that you need to follow, gives you commandlets that you need to run, every single instruction that you can imagine. And if you follow those steps, auto-reseed will actually not be able to encrypt a disk because of how we implemented a property. So it's the AutoDAG BitLocker enabled property, which was what we were trying to turn on with this commandlet. But when we turned it on, the way we've implemented it in code actually maps to the way in which we've deployed Exchange in Exchange Online. And with respect to that piece of the code, the way we deploy it online is just a little bit different from how we do it on premises. So the implementation of this property works perfectly as we'd expect in online, doesn't work at all in on-premises. So there's two temporary solutions. One is to take the certificates that are used by BitLocker and manually copy them to every single Exchange server so that they're all using the same certificate and they can all do the encryption and decryption. Another one is to use a BitLocker data recovery agent. Frankly, I don't care for either of those solutions. I would much rather have you leave BitLocker turned off in the short term until we get the new CU out. We expect this to hopefully be in CU4, but I checked the bug today and it has not been fixed, so I can't give you an exact date as to when it's coming in, but I have very good reason to believe that this will be fixed in CU4, and then you can use auto-reseed with BitLocker again. But for right now, auto-reseed is awesome by itself. BitLocker is awesome by itself. If you put them together, it's a no-go right now. So that's something, unfortunately, we didn't catch until it was too late. And so, like I said, we're working on trying to fix that. Now, I mentioned that auto-reseed can automatically format the disks for you as well. There is a manual way. If the administrator wants to do it manually, you can do that. But if you just want to put in a blank raw disk into the slot and have auto-reseed take it from there, you can do that too. The default format in auto-reseed is NTFS, but we have added file type properties or file system properties to the DAG, one specifically that you can set to either NTFS or resilient file system, REFS. So actually, resilient file system is something that we would want you to take advantage of, not because of the inherent resiliency features in that, but just because there are some disk corruption scenarios that you'll be better off with if the resiliency file system is in place versus NTFS. NTFS is still a fantastic file system. I'm sure it's working great for many of you out there, but there are a couple disk corruption scenarios that NTFS has to deal with that REFS does not. Now, set database availability group has a file system property that I mentioned. If you set it to REFS, then auto-reseed will automatically format things if REFS. If you don't, then one of two things will happen. It will either use the default, and meaning NTFS, or it will look at the properties of the drive in AD, that file system property stored in AD. So if auto-reseed, when it comes to the drive it needs to replace, if it looks up in AD and sees that the prior drive, which is now quarantined, was REFS, then the drive will automatically be formatted as REFS. But if you want a DAG-wide default, just set it at the DAG level, and then it will format it that. We also introduced in CU2 this preference move frequency property. So many of you might be aware that For a couple years now, we've had this redistribute active databases script that we ship in the box. Just simply due to the inherent nature of DAGs, with database copies being activated and failover and switchovers happening, DAGs become what we call unbalanced. Okay? They're no longer balanced according to their activation preference, the activation preference being an administrator set value on a database copy that is the administrator's way of telling the system what database should be activated first in the event of a failure. So there are whole numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, depending on how many database copies that you have. And periodically, you would run this script, or maybe even some of you set it up as a scheduled script to redistribute the databases. What we've done in CU2 now is we've added this property, this preference move frequency property. And when you use that, you're basically telling the DAG now how often it should check for this unbalance and reactivate your lowest activation preference copies, the one with the value of 1. Now, there's two issues that got introduced with this, though. The thing works great, but the default value is 1 hour, and unfortunately in the code, when you're running getDAG, it actually reports that default value as $null. So that will give you the mistaken impression that the feature is actually turned off when it's not. It's actually on, we just aren't reporting it correctly. Now, if you do want to turn the feature off, the way we told you to do that in the instructions, which is basically setting it to a time span of 0, that actually will be ignored in code, and that won't work. You actually have to use the system.threading.timeout ::infinite time span. Setting it to that is the only way to disable this preference move frequency feature. Again, minor bugs, minor things that you have to worry about, but they are things that we are working on fixing. I would expect this to be fixed in CU4 as well. All right. Let's talk about some transport stuff. Again, I want to give props to a major transport session, the Exchange Online Protection session, Friday, 10:45. You won't want to miss that. All right. How many of you are using email address internationalization? How many of you are using non-ASCII characters in either usernames or domain names? It's kind of a weird question to ask in North America, I know, but still, there may be some of you. All right, there are a few of you. So it's very confusing, I find, to customers what our EAI support stance is, even though we've actually had EAI support in Exchange for quite some time. So EAI could be on the user portion, it could be on the domain portion, or it could be the whole thing. As you can see these examples. So you can see the Cyrillic characters that literally says user at domain. I know you can't decipher that. And the other one is also user at domain. So you can see at domain on the top one for 2010 and 2013. And then in 2016, we supported for the username and the email address. Exchange Online actually supports both, and we've been deploying that worldwide. We should just about be finished, if we're not already. So if you're in online mode, we automatically cover everything for you. If you're on premises, then depending on what version you're running, you will get part or full support, depending on what version of Exchange. All right, anti-spoofing. This is something that's pretty serious to talk about. For many months, maybe the last 18 to 24 months, both our digital cybercrime unit and the EOP folks, along with other security folks, have seen these massive increases in targeted spear phishing attacks. Massive increases. We're talking like a 50,000-fold increase in what we were seeing, say, for instance, three and a half years ago. It's just a massive, massive increase. If you're not familiar with those are, a spear phishing attack is just like a regular phishing attack, except it's targeted. Typically targeted to somebody very, very high up in the company, like the CFO, the CIO, the CEO, somebody. And typically the way it works, as you can see with this message, is you get this message that's spoofed. It looks like it's coming from somebody else in the organization. They pay especially particular attention to grammar and spelling, so when you read the message, everything looks correct, everything looks the way you'd expect it to be, except it's a fake message. But it looks legitimate enough to fool people. And in this case, to fool people in triggering a $50,000 wire. Now, these messages are typically sent in a low volume when they find a target, because if the target suddenly gets 10 different messages asking for a $50,000 wire transfer, that's going to look suspicious. But once they have the target in mind, they'll just send them one of those. Okay? And that'll be one, like I said, that will look completely correct. No spelling errors, no grammar errors. There may be the appropriate company logos, proper return addresses. Everything looks beautiful, except this is a malicious and fraudulent message. So EOP, Exchange Online Protection, already has a lot of anti-spoofing technology built into it. And this can actually help you defend against a lot of the attacks that we're seeing going on today. So things like SPF, DKIM, DMARC, all those things are in there now as anti-spoofing mechanisms within Exchange Online and Office 365. So for example, we support the domain-based messaging authentication reporting and conformance, or DMARC standard. And that is to stop spoofing from the from domain, which is the example I used in those messages that I shared you. So DMARC is something that acts as an authentication protocol that can help stop these messages. DMARC is very similar to some additional anti-spoofing messages or message technology that we have, except that the EOP native technology doesn't require DNS records, and DMARC does. A second difference is that we've got very rich reporting on malicious messages, or really all the messages in the environment, that you can get either through the Exchange Admin Center or through remote PowerShell. That's not something that you can get with DMARC. DMARC is only going to send to whoever the authorized person is to get this reporting information, versus having multiple admins be able to just get the rich reporting information and find out what kind of spoofing you're dealing with in your organization. Now, a few months ago, we rolled out this feature called Exact Domain Spear Phishing Protection, or what we call Business Email Compromise. This is specific detection for spoofing of your domain, even if you don't do anything around SPF or DKIM or DMARC. So if the administrator takes zero action to prevent against spoofing of your domain, we now have a feature that will jump in there and take care of it. And better yet, you don't have to do anything. It's free and it's automatic. It just gets turned on for everyone, and you've got out-of-box anti-spoofing. Of course, you can customize it if you want to tailor it to your organization's needs. You can tighten the controls. You can loosen the controls a little bit. And you can also have other administrators involved with managing as well. But it is free and it's automatic. Now, one of the challenges with anti-spoofing, though, is mailing lists. How many are you on some sort of mailing list? Yeah, probably a lot of you, okay? So the way mailing lists work, you know, with the routing and the rewriting and the delivery and stuff, they end up being, with respect to anti-spoofing, a pretty big source of false positives. So there is something coming along. It's called Authenticated Receive Chain, or ARC for short. And we're hoping that that is going to provide a solution to this. So ARC was recently ratified as an industry standard, I want to say back in June. You can go to that website and find out. And then if you go to the anti-spoofing link, we'll talk about all the information, how ARC is coming for Exchange Online, and give you the best practices that you need to follow to protect your own domains. But like I said before, with the business email compromise feature, even if you take no action to protect your domains from being spoofed, we're now going to step in and give you that protection out of the box. Now, there's some mail relay changes that are coming, and they're coming very soon. We're like 3 months away from making a very significant change. So how many of you need to send NDRs to internet recipients that are relayed through Office 365? Two, okay. How many of you need to send messages from an on-premises mail server to any Office 365 domain that's not yours? Now, really, everybody with an on-premises server should raise their hand. I mean, come on. That's basically, do you email other people who might also be subscribers to Office 365? Yeah. Any of you using forwarding rules for relaying messages that originate on premises and go through Office 365 for other domains? Yeah, a few of you as well. It's very, very, very popular mergers and acquisitions. So if any of these things are true, you're going to need to take action, because starting February 1st of next year, again, just a few months away, we are changing the default behavior, and none of these scenarios will be supported as is. There is action that you need to take. And that action is, you've got to create a connector, and that connector has to be an Office 365 that tells the service to use a certificate to authenticate email. You also, your own email server has to be configured to use that same certificate when sending mail to Office 365, and it has to be a domain that is one of yours in Office 365, so a domain that you've entered as authoritative in Exchange Online in this case. If you don't make any of those changes, all three of those scenarios will break on February 1st. And February 1st is actually a hard date. It's not a date where we're like, oh, we'll give people two more weeks. It's actually the date we're going to flip the switch and make the change. So if you notice on February 1st that a lot of mail's getting queued up and not being delivered the way you expect, chances are it's because we made a relay mail change and you now need to go change your environment. The other change that's coming is we are deprecating smart screen. Smart screen technology has been in Exchange and Outlook, among other places. It's also in Internet Explorer and Windows and Edge and so forth. But for smart screen in Outlook and Exchange, that is being deprecated. And here we're kind of using the term deprecated loosely. Deprecated typically means it's in this release, but it's not going to be in the next release. But because our releases are kind of a blur in the cloud, what we really mean is it's just going to go away. Okay, we're going to stop producing updates. And that's going to happen even sooner. That's happening November 1st of this year. So basically 2 months from now or a month from now, we are stopping producing the updates. Now, it's not going to immediately affect you. The existing signature file updates that you have on your servers at that time will still continue to work. Okay? They'll just become less and less effective over time because they won't be kept up to date. So this is going to affect Exchange 2016 and earlier, so 2013, 2010, 2007, everyone's going to be affected. Outlook 2016 and 2013, 2010, 2007 for Windows, and Outlook 2011 for Mac. Those are the only places that we're removing it from. Okay? We're not taking it out of Internet Explorer. We're not taking it out of Edge. We're not taking it out of Windows. They'll still continue to use Smart Screen, and they'll still continue to get updates for them. But we won't have it in Exchange anymore, and we don't have it in Outlook anymore. And as I mentioned, the existing filter and definitions will still work, and Outlook's junk email options will still stay the same, but again, eventually, things will work less and less effectively as time goes on and the updates that you have, which are now frozen in time, are older and older. All right. Now, here's a fun section I call Watch Out. Because these are things that you really need to watch out for. These are bugs that you don't know about, or things that we know customers are doing that we do not want you to do. So, as an example, how many of you want to use modern authentication on premises? A few of you. How many of you have heard of modern authentication? All right. So, the few of you that want to do it on premises, don't do it. And I say this because I know so many of you are so savvy about these kinds of things, and I know a lot of you have figured out that, hey, the steps for enabling modern authentication for Exchange Online are the same steps you'd use on premises. So why don't I just do those steps and do it on premises? Don't do that, okay? It won't work. First of all, anybody who has Outlook for Mac clients, you will instantly break all of your Outlook for Mac clients. They will not work once you enable modern authentication on premises. Now, as far as your other Outlook clients go, guess what? They also won't work. It's not supported yet. Don't even try. The steps look the same, but they're not exactly the same. There's actually one key piece of configuration that is missing from those steps that is absolutely necessary on premises. And in fact, it's so secret, that's all I can tell you about it. I can't even tell you what that configuration is, how it's implemented, or where it would exist. All I can tell you is that none of you will ever know what it is until we release it, and until we release it, it won't work. So don't even try to do this right now. And again, this doesn't seem like a big deal, but we have customers doing this, and we get support calls that Outlook for Mac clients aren't working now. And we're like, well, what did you do? Well, we turned on modern authentication. Don't do that. Okay, public folders. How many of you still using public folders? Oh, that's a lot of you. Wow. Just to be clear, legacy public folders? Okay, modern public folders. Ooh, it's almost tied. All right. Well, public folders, there's a slight issue with Outlook 2016 in public folders. And it's specific when you have the mailbox either on 2013 and 2016 and a public folders on Exchange 2010. So who's got a 2010 and 2013 mixed environment? Anybody? Anybody have a 2010 and 2016 mixed environment? All right. And does that include public folders? Watch out. Because without the correct auto-discover response, Outlook will not be able to access and connect to the public folders. Okay, so this is a very specific scenario. So what you have to do is Outlook requires that there's a public folder information section inside the auto-discover response that it gets. And that has to point to a public folder discovery mailbox that, unfortunately, is on the same server as the user's mailbox. Now, the odds of that happening are pretty slim, so you have to do that yourself. Now, fortunately, Bill Long, our public folder guru inside of Microsoft, came up with a sample script that is now on a GitHub and available for download, and it will go through and it will make all the correct configuration changes so that the public folder information section does have the correct information in there. That information will then get passed to Outlook, and Outlook will be able to connect to the public folders. But if you don't do that, you're going to run into issues where Outlook cannot connect to public folders if you're in that specific mixed scenario. If you're in a uniform scenario, everyone's 2013, everyone's 2010, everyone's 2016, you won't have a problem, but in a mixed environment, there are specific configuration changes that are required. The other thing that you want to do in a 2013 and 2016 mixed environment is you want to make sure that the public folder mailbox that has the primary hierarchy, the one that's writable, is on the later version, is on a 2016. If it's not, it's going to break public folder synchronization. It's going to break down-level OWA clients, including Outlook on the web, so they won't be able to see them through the favorites mechanism. And even if you were to add a secondary hierarchy on Exchange 2016, that secondary hierarchy will not be synchronized. So it will be out of date. Okay, so watch out for that. The other thing to watch out with respect to public folders is how many of you are using journaling today? All right, it's probably more hands than I expected. That's a fair number. Unfortunately, with journaling, the public folder synchronization messages are getting caught. And so anytime public folders sync hierarchy or content with each other's, those messages will get picked up by the journaling system and sent to wherever you're having your journal emails go. So we do have a fix for that. The fix came literally 2 days after we closed up for CU3. So we didn't make it in CU3. I completely expect it to be in CU4. And once that's out, that would fix it for you. In the meantime, unfortunately, really the only workarounds we have are one is to disable journaling, which I'm sure for those of you using it is not a viable workaround. But the other one would be to inject a transport rule and then create a rule based on the recipient to move messages around. That, depending on how you're using journaling, could also be too much work for you to do. So you might just wait a few months for CU4 and manually clean out the journaled email messages. All right. How many of you have used our PST import tool? A few, all right. How many of you have a parent-child domain configuration where you've got your Exchange servers in a parent domain and your users in a child domain? All right, well, that's, again, more hands than I expected. So there is a problem in that specific configuration when you're trying to use the PST import tool. So if you go into EAC to import it, you'll get that error message. Now, EAC has a problem doing it because EAC doesn't really let you pick which domain controller you're going to talk to. PowerShell does with the domain controller parameter. So the workaround for this now is to just go into PowerShell and add the domain controller parameter, specify DC in the child domain where the users are, and then PST import will work. So a short way to think of this is if you're in this scenario, you won't be able to do GUI imports of PSTs until we fix this. In the meantime, this will be something that you'll have to do PowerShell. Now, I did just say until we fix this. I will tell you, though, the bug is currently marked as won't fix. And so what that means is that I don't really expect this to be fixed, but you know, we've had bugs that are flipped. You know, if there's a big enough customer demand to fix something or a serious enough business case where it's affecting it, then we've got the opportunity to go and re-triage that bug and reevaluate where it is with respect to the bug bar. So it might be fixed eventually, but right now it is tagged as won't fix. So keep that in mind and watch out for that. Anybody deployed Office Online Server, or what we call WAC internally? Now that everybody knows what WAC stands for, hopefully. So this is a new server that we introduced with Exchange 2016. It's a very specific type of server. It's dedicated, so it's got to run on its own box. Can't have Exchange, can't have SharePoint, can't have AD on it. It's got to be dedicated to that system. It runs on Windows 2012 R2. And it can support multiple workloads, both on-premises and in the cloud. So SharePoint, Exchange, down-level versions of Link, and up-level versions of Skype. And it's available only through volume licensing. So if you don't have a volume license agreement or an Office 365 SA subscription, you won't be able to download and get access to this. If you can have access to it, basically what it does, it provides the Office Online experience for Outlook on the web clients. So it used to be where Outlook web app would do the rendering of Word documents, PowerPoint documents, and so forth by itself. Now it will look to the Office Online server if you've configured one to do that for previews. Now, if you have Exchange 2013 servers, do not configure the configuration endpoint to be at the organizational level. That will actually break. It will take all of the Exchange 2013 servers and direct them to use the Office Online server directly. That isn't supported. They have to go through the Exchange 2016. Also, if you want users outside of the network to be able to view this stuff, you're going to have to punch open 443 on your firewall and let traffic in from the internet to this server. If you don't, then users who are using Outlook on the web won't be able to see these preview attachments. Also, previewing over S/MIME is not yet supported. How many of you folks are using S/MIME today? Okay, just a few of you. Typically, we see S/MIME used almost exclusively in the military. But there are some customers that are using that, just keep in mind. But the bigger gotcha around this and the common call generator that we have is the Office Online server uses OAuth to communicate and authenticate with the Exchange and or SharePoint servers that are using it. What happens is there's a certificate for collaboration that gets created on the Exchange server. And then the MS Exchange service host process is responsible for taking that certificate and copying it to all the other Exchange servers in the organization. Unfortunately, a lot of administrators are not paying attention to this. And in fact, some are even deleting the certificate. And when you do that, that will break not just OAuth authentication, but the whole Office Online server experience as well. When I say common call generator, I mean we are getting a ridiculous number of calls on people who have deleted or done something to their certificate or configured the server in such a way that the service host can no longer communicate with other Exchange servers. And evidence of that can be very easily seen in the event log. You'll see a couple events that will show up. 2004 and 2005 are the two warning events that tells you there's a certificate missing. But you can also use PowerShell to see. If you run get Exchange certificate, it'll tell you whether or not the certificate is there. If it's present, you'll see output similar to the top square. If it's missing because it was deleted or whatever, then you'll see the output on the bottom, which gives you the error message. The good news is, if you run into this And you may be running with it right now and not realizing it, but if you run into this, it's just two commands to fix it. That's it, just run new Exchange server, generate a new certificate, and then use set auth config to tell OAuth to use that certificate for authentication purposes. So it is an easy fix, but we're just getting a seriously high volume of calls on this, indicating that a lot of customers are just killing the certificate when they shouldn't be. So keep that in mind. Oh no, Bedlam. Uh-oh, Bedlam. Are you all familiar with Bedlam? Is everybody familiar with Bedlam? All right. Well, if you're not familiar with Bedlam, it really refers to a scenario in which you have this reply all storm. And we've had some pretty famous instances of Bedlam inside of Microsoft. One that's referred to on the screen, which was DL3. We had a DL4, which was the Blue Hat conference. We've had a lot of Bedlam gone. We've had so much Bedlam gone that we actually made a game called Bedlam that you can only get at the Microsoft company store and only if you're a Microsoft employee. So I happen to have one here. It's all shrink-wrapped, never been opened. I'm not giving it away. I just wanted you to know I had it. I lied. I am giving it away. Somewhere under one of the chairs that all of you are sitting on right now is my business card. And whoever looks under their chair and finds my business card, it is taped under there, so you may need to reach and pull, but whoever reaches down and finds it is now the proud owner of this Bedlam game. Now, I will also say, if a Microsoft person wins, they have to give it to an attendee. This is not, Microsoft people are not eligible. Oh, we have a winner. All right, come on up and get your game. Let me just take a look at that real quick. Yep, that's it. There you go. Congratulations, enjoy. Thank you, all right. All right. You guys are all clapping, even though you lost. That was very, very decent. Very decent. You're good people. All right. Let's talk about some odds and ends. So this is kind of an area where it's kind of a potpourri of stuff that is top of mind to some of the Exchange senior leadership folks, and top of mind to our support folks, and top of mind to those of us who are very passionate about customers having a really good on-premises experience or a really good cloud experience, depending on where they are. So let's talk again real briefly about public folders. This is good news. This isn't the watch out section. So I just want to reiterate what our limits are. We're working very hard to increase these limits, but right now, both Exchange Online and Exchange On-Premises have a maximum number of 1,000 public folder modern public folder mailboxes. Now, in Exchange Online, we can let you take those 1,000 public folder mailboxes and create 1,000,000 folders in them. In Exchange On-Premises, the number is a little less. You can only do 100,000. Okay? I would hope most of you are not going to go for the 1,000,000. But what we are looking for right now is customers, particularly on Exchange 2010, who have anywhere between 100,000 to 500,000 public folders in the legacy hierarchy. You can email this contact alias that you see up here, and you can be a part of the migration test program that we've spun up, and you can actually help us test and exercise and not only migrate your stuff to the cloud, but also make sure that our code can have other customers doing the same thing as well. So this is kind of a migration preview program, if you will. This is different from being in the TAP program, which I'll talk about later, but this is not the same thing. So the requirements for being in TAP are pretty stringent. The requirements for this are much less stringent. So you don't have to run pre-release software in your environment, for example. So if you have a lot of public folders and you're on 2010 and you want to go to the cloud, please contact us. We will hold your hand and get your data there and at the same time capture the telemetry and statistics and whatnot to help us do better. Another common question we get is around data residency, or specifically, where is my data? Okay, where is it? So we have this website, this data center map. It's an Azure website that we created. It's unfortunately out of date. If you look at the map, for example, this is what we're showing for North American data centers. Now, I know some of you aren't going to know this, but there's actually a couple data centers missing from this map right now. For example, we've had Exchange running in Cheyenne, Wyoming for years. Not on here, but it's still running there. It's still there. We've also have more data centers in Virginia than what we show on here as well. So let me show you another way to look at this. Again, the geo maps that I'm showing you now, I've intentionally made to match the Azure maps. So this and this are equal in so much as they are both showing the same information. So I've created additional maps that are missing data centers, but only to illustrate a point. And so one point is that when we deploy Exchange in North America, it's not the same in every geo, but in North America, we have one active copy and three passive copies. So four copies, and we also replicate to four data centers. So every copy is in its own data center. Here you can see I've got the active in green, or blue rather, so that's in Quincy, and we're replicating in this case to Chicago, Boynton, Virginia, and San Antonio. Okay, so at this given moment, if my mailbox is in that database, that's where my data is located. But as we all know, in 30 seconds, that could change. You know, once you have a failover, that activation is going to happen. Actually, it'll happen in about 15 seconds now with the code we're running. So in 15 seconds, my active copy of my data now just went from Quincy, now it's in Chicago. And now that's where the active copy, so we replicate out from Chicago. And again, that could change. You know, maybe it'll go to San Antonio, or maybe San Antonio will be just where the lag copy is. So everything is highly available, but the data is moving around in terms of where the actual active location is at any given time. Now, some folks have figured out that if you run get mailbox, that will display the name of the server on which your mail is running. Some folks have also figured out that if you look at the first couple letters of that server name, it can possibly tell you where things are. Or can it? How many of you know where CY1 is? Didn't think so. Really? You think you know? Where is it? No. Yes, it is. Okay. Damn it. Okay, BL2. How many of you know where BL2 is? Haha, you'll never get it. Haha. Nope. Ashburn, not even on the list. Ashburn, also in Virginia, which is near Blue Ridge. Santa Clara, that's in California, if you didn't know that. And then the other one, San Antonio, SN2. Now, this is not all the data centers or all the servers they have. And I'll tell you how to decipher this. You can see that the first couple letters are, in fact, the data center. The second few letters are the environment. So when you see that PR, that's production. All of you are in our production environment. The next set that you see that O3, that tells us what Active Directory resource force that machine is in. The MB, that tells us the role, MB for mailbox. And the number at the end, that's simply the server's unique number. But knowing any of that information isn't going to do you any good, and it's really not going to tell you where your quote-unquote data is, because the data could change at any given moment. Now, obviously, we're not replicating outside of geos. So those of you who are in the cloud today with your data in North America, it's in North America. Okay, it's not going to be in EMEA. It's not going to be in APAC. It's going to be in North America. We're contractually obligated to keep it that way for you. But knowing where the data is really isn't going to be very helpful to you. Knowing that your mailbox happens to be active in Cheyenne versus Ashburn is completely meaningless. There's no action or no knowledge or no benefit to knowing that. So if you want to know where things are, you could use get mailbox, or you could just look in the new admin center, because now with Exchange, SharePoint, and Skype for Business, we are now telling you the geo in which your data resides. Okay, so obviously we're not telling you the server on which it resides, because servers come and go. Believe it or not, the typical lifespan of a server, any given server running in Exchange Online, is how long do you think it is? How long do you think they last? Shout it out if you think you know. 90 days? What did I hear? I heard 2 weeks. It's 2 weeks. Yeah. So servers typically live for 2 weeks, then they get wiped and redone or whatever. It might also surprise you to know that in our Gen 5 data centers, our newest ones, we, and when I say we, I mean Microsoft actually manufactures the servers themselves. So if you hear people telling you that, oh, Microsoft uses this hardware or that hardware, it's not true. We make the hardware ourselves. And when you see these servers, they don't look anything like a server. There's no bezel, there's no branding, there's nothing on it. We don't put anything on a server that is not absolutely needed. If it's not used in the service, it's not part of the server build and it's not in the rack. So the, one of the pictures I had in the video when you saw the million server quote, that was showing you a rack of servers that we ourselves manufacture. That's how large our cloud service has become. We do not manufacture for anyone else. We don't sell them, but we manufacture the servers in our own data centers. And like I said, those could come and go. So tracking the database or the server where it is, that's completely meaningless. You really are just concerned with making sure data residency is in the right geo, and now we're telling you that through the new admin center. All right, let's talk about reconnecting archived mailboxes, because it's not quite the same as reconnecting a regular disconnected mailbox. I would hope by now everybody in this room knows what a disconnected mailbox is, but if you don't, that's what a mailbox becomes when you delete the user. Okay, so you remove the user account. The mailbox is really just an attribute of the user security principle object. So when you delete the user, the mailbox is still in the Exchange database, and now it's in a disconnected form. For a regular mailbox, it's very easy to reconnect it. You can use PowerShell, you can use EAC to do that. It's super easy, and in fact, when you delete a mailbox, it'll show up right away in both PowerShell and EAC as a disconnected mailbox in Exchange Online. So to reconnect a primary mailbox using the EAC, it's very simple. You just use the GUI to do that, and I've given you the PowerShell command to do that, but you can't reconnect an archive mailbox doing that same way. Instead, you have to grab the GUID for the archive mailbox and then pass that into enable mailbox through PowerShell. So there is basically no GUI way to reconnect an archive mailbox. It's all PowerShell, and it's all done through these commandlets, one of which that I said requires you to get the GUID first. All right. Here's a quick and easy one, but we get asked this all the time. I'm an admin, or I'm a consultant, or I'm somebody who just has a lot of remote PowerShell windows open to X service. It could be Exchange on premises, could be Exchange Online, could even be SharePoint or Skype for Business, anywhere you can connect remote PowerShell. How do I tell, looking at a console window, what my security credentials are, who I am, what user I'm logged in as? Well, there's actually a couple things that you could do. The one that is the easiest to do, I've put up here in the black. There's a couple different options available to you. There's also the write output option in PowerShell and the write host option in PowerShell as well. And I've got examples for you on how to do that in the notes of this section. All right. A couple more things, and then we're going to wrap up. How many of you have heard of Secure Score? Okay, not too many. Oh, yay. I mean, not yay, but yay, I get to tell you about it. Secure Score is a brand new service. It's actually in preview right now, and it's kind of like a credit score for the security of your Exchange Online tenant, and actually for all Office 365 tenants. So the way it works is you go into Secure Score. I'm going to actually go ahead and show you some of the stuff. So you go into Secure Score, and it gives you first this dialogue that you have to agree to, because you have to give permission to your tenant for this app to do it. It is an app that we created by us, but it's an app that runs outside of Office 365, so it needs permission to do things. When you give it that permission, then it will evaluate the security profile and configuration of your tenant and tell you what your secure score is. And again, it's kind of like a credit score. And we describe it that way because it's basically looking at your behaviors and looking at the things that you can do to improve your score or reduce your score. And we'll tell you what those things are. You know, we'll give you, for instance, actions that you can take or actions that the system is looking at in terms of creating this score for you. So if you're not using, for instance, any encryption for your messages, you might have a lower secure score. If you're not using DLP to stop information leakage from happening, you might have a lower secure score. Now, it might be that you don't need those features, or it might be that you just don't know about them or know how to configure them. So again, Secure Score can teach you how to do that stuff. The last thing I want to talk about are a couple portals that we've created. One is a standalone portal. The other is now in the Security and Compliance Center. One is called Service Assurance. That's in the Security and Compliance Center, or what used to be called the Protection Center. So you can get there still with protection.office.com. The other is the Service Trust Portal, and that's a separate portal where your global admin from your tenant comes and onboards you and gets your tenant access to this information. I mention these because both the Service Trust Portal and Service Assurance include an entire library of deep dive white papers around Office 365, Azure, Dynamics CRM, Intune, and other cloud services. Not only do we have the things like ISO, SOC, FedRAMP, and other audit reports there for you to download, but we've got these white papers that tell you stuff that you can't find this information anywhere else. So how we do tenant isolation in Office 365, how we do data resiliency, how we do data encryption, all through Office 365. All of those deep dive white papers are available for you, in this case, from the trust documents section. So this is what it looks like. This is what service assurance looks like. Service assurance is actually, whoops, went too far. Service Assurance, like I said, is part of the Security and Compliance Center. So when you go in there, you'll see the same compliance reports, you'll see the same trust documents, but you'll also see a new feature called Audited Controls, which is basically a listing. Right now we've got the ISO 27001 and 27018 standards up there. So we give you a listing of every single control that was audited by third-party auditors in those standards, and we tell you what the implementation details are for that control, and we tell you what the evidence was that we produced to the auditor to let them know that we had those controls. All right. And the last thing I'm going to mention is, I did mention the Exchange TAP earlier. For those of you who are interested in joining the Exchange TAP, the Technology Adoption Program, or our pre-release program, go to the booth, find a TAP PM, look for David Espinoza. If you can't find David, there's his email address. You can email him directly and ask that you be included. All right, I'm out of time, and that's it for me. So please enjoy the rest of the show.